Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It came back to me in a moment. Standing in the icy dark of an October evening in Cork, the Butter Exchange brass and reed band barumphing through an open door into the alleyway, and my two-year-old crying at my feet. The flute will get cold, I thought. I have to go back inside. But she was clinging to my legs and insisting she wanted up. I gave her a crooked one-armed hug and blew some warm air into the mouthpiece. I couldn't remember why it mattered. Something about cold instruments playing flat notes, or sharp notes. And then I wondered, how do I know this anyway? I hadn't played the flute much in the last 30 years. When I first took lessons, it was with an elderly nun who travelled from house to house to teach. She had no car and no bicycle. Instead, she depended on lifts from her pupils, or rather their parents, a musical chain carrying her from place to place. Now that I was back playing an instrument I'd hardly picked up in all that time, her voice regularly sounded in my ear. When I missed a note, or blew too hard, or drooped a little in my chair, I knew too well what she would say. She was strict, as accomplished technicians can be, but she indulged me too, though I was a bit of a sloppy pupil. I learned quickly, but I was not the serious music student she deserved. I'd listened to myself playing with half an ear. Listening too hard meant I'd be shamed into more practice. Back to the band room. My daughter had been packed back into her buggy and was trundling down the Shandon cobbles with her dad. She was right to complain. It was cold, it was dark, and a bit too close to bedtime. Her older brother was a bit more cheerful when he left. He told me the band was too loud, but he danced along to the music anyway. I squeezed back into the Butterer's tiny band room, its walls papered in decades of newspaper clippings, band portraits and wedding photographs. After 146 years and all the players that had passed through the Butterer in that time, for the moment I was the only flute in the band. That suited me just fine. I could tell myself any mistakes would be muffled by the louder brass instruments. I hoped so anyway. My flute teacher would sometimes chat while she waited for a car to take her to her next student. She told me one day how her father had donated her piano to the convent when she had entered the order. I wondered if he had been proud or sorrowful to see his talented daughter go. Perhaps both. She would have a new name, cut her hair and wear the habit. But he had ensured that she would have something of her old self with her. Or at least he tried to. At some point, the nuns gave her piano away, or she was moved elsewhere and the piano stayed behind. I don't quite remember which, but I do know that she lost it. Her father's gesture was in vain. But more often, my teacher didn't spend the extra time chatting. Instead, the lesson would go on and on, while I peered out the window, willing her next driver to arrive. Blowing away for so long, I'd get dizzy with the effort. Over time, when I went away to college and the lessons ended, the flute was packed away. And then I didn't think of embouchure and pitch and tone and those endless afternoons for a very long time. What surprises me now are the things we carry with us from one life to another. Unlike my two-year-old, I am not a Cork native. I arrived in the city in the middle of the first COVID lockdown with a six-month-old baby. I thought, in the summer of 2020, that life would be back to normal soon. That was a bit optimistic. But as the world slowly opened up, and after I was through the first year of another new baby's life, a chance encounter brought me to the Butterer, and I opened up my flute case again. At a lonely point in a new city, suddenly a piece of my old life re-emerged, and it helped me to become part of a new community. I'm sure I've forgotten most of what my old music teacher taught me. I'm sure she wouldn't be too impressed with my technique these days. But what I remember now is the simple joy of playing music. And it's strange to realise only now, so many decades afterwards, what a gift she gave me. ¶¶
As I walked through the gates of the Royal and Prior Boarding School in Raphoe, County Donegal, for the first time in September 1988, I felt the weight of history on my shoulders. Then I realised it was just my father's large hand, engaged in a gesture midway between a reassuring touch and a nudge over the finishing line, ensuring that number 11 of his 12 children would now be fed by someone else for the best part of their teenage years. My older brother Gordon, who we were to lose far too young in a car crash, little more than a decade later, was then entering his fifth year. He strode ahead on familiar ground, as I took in everything and wondered what this new world might bring. I was number 6 of a total of 7 of our Regan clan to avail of a grant from the Protestant Board of Education to attend the boarding school, 4 of my sisters having passed through the gates before Gordon, while my younger brother Stuart finished the run by starting the following September. Content that I was set up in a bunk bed alongside the other 20-odd freshmen in the first-year dorm, my folks didn't dilly-dally too long, and after exchanging some pleasantries with other parents about how delighted they all were to offload another offspring to the care of relative strangers who lived miles away, they went home to Leitrim. Gordon appeared and started showing me around the building, but was quickly accosted by 2 excited friends. "Did you hear about Spud? Matron cut his hair. He's up in the dorm now." Without another word, they bolted off before Gordon turned and beckoned me to follow them up a set of stairs. When I arrived in the fifth year dorm, a huddle had already formed around one bed, with people jostling for positions. Amid the gasps and hoots of laughter, I heard a whimper. "It took me all summer to grow that." The bodies parted, and there, sitting in a sad Buddha-like pose, with a tussle of curls in his hands and tears in his eyes, was Jason Spud McKinley, whom I would, over the course of the year, come to know as one of the soundest lads in the place. I can't definitively say that witnessing this mock epic scene is the reason why Alexander Pope's The Rape of the Lock would become one of my favourite poems, but it must have been a factor. Such a display of vulnerability by boys in the boarding school was rare. It was and remains all too rare amongst the male of the species generally. But I exhibited an involuntary public display of it myself later that term, and it taught me some valuable lessons. Every year, each dorm would enter a team into a five-a-side soccer tournament. Boys only, in a sad reflection of the times, despite the likes of my fellow first years, Jenny Maxwell and Lucille Miles, being fine footballers. We had a great little team, but came up against the fancied prefects in the semi-final. Against all the odds, we won. And to this day, one of my favourite memories is the joy I felt when Gordon ran onto the field at the final whistle and embraced me before hoisting me into the air. In that brotherly way, Gordon and I knew that we loved each other. But at that stage of our lives, this was the closest to a verbal articulation of that love we had managed. We would face his fifth-year team in the final. As the only first-year team to have reached that stage of the competition, the game generated a bit more interest than usual. It was a gorgeous day, and many of the 160 or so boarders turned out to watch, with a row perched along the wall of the pitch chattering like starlings on a rooftop. They hammered us. As captain, I was called to collect on behalf of my team the loser's shield from the housemaster. I still find it hard to name the feelings that caused me to burst out crying in front of the entire boarding school the moment I received it. I wasn't the lachrymose child. Undoubtedly, disappointment was the main one, but the tension of the occasion, combined with some physical and emotional exhaustion, allowed me tap into deeper rivers than that too. As a 13-year-old boy, I certainly knew the emotion that followed the waterworks: utter embarrassment. All I could see, real or perceived, was horror in the eyes of the young men and boys all around me. I wanted the ground to open up and swallow me. And then a strange thing happened. As I made my way back to my teammates, I was encircled by a few of the senior girls, beautiful creatures, way out of my league or even orbit, peers of Gordon's, who enveloped me in a circle of feminine love and understanding and mothered me to within an inch of my life. A few things occurred to me in the aftermath of that experience, some hitting me immediately, others dripping slowly like pennies from heaven over the course of subsequent decades and life experiences. Number one, girls dig emotional vulnerability. Number two, sometimes you learn more from losing than winning. And number three, hug your brothers and tell them you love them whenever you can. You never know when it might be your last chance.
Long,
a long, long road
with many a winding turn that leads us to who knows where, who knows where,
who knows where.
But I'm strong enough to care.
On the 15th of June 1992, the editorial page of the New York Times pronounced on the UN climate conference in Rio and the situation in the Baltic states. It also found space for a paragraph about an impromptu event the previous day in Central Park. The paper's editor had come across a man singing songs by the lake. David Ippolito, a session musician, had been performing there for the first time that Sunday and just happened to have one of the city's leading journalists in his accidental audience. Out of that chance encounter grew a weekend tradition whereby a bunch of New Yorkers and an ever-changing group of tourists became what my friend the Dean of Christchurch Dublin calls a community in the moment, or as David christened us in one of his songs, the people on the hill. I say us because my wife and I discovered David a dozen or so years later. It was our first summer in New York, June 2005. The temperature was regularly above 90 degrees that year, from late April until almost October. And as another New Yorker almost sang, it's a long, long time from May to September. Each weekend we escaped from the heat of our apartment to the cool of the park, in particular to the Ramble, a rocky, shady patch in its southwest corner. One Sunday afternoon, as we were leaving the Ramble, we heard through the trees the voice of a man, with a guitar, singing James Taylor's Sweet Baby James. We followed the sound to the edge of the lake and found the man, stripped to the waist, wearing only a pair of faded blue jeans, an acoustic guitar slung around his shoulder, and a small crowd of listeners spread out on the grass. That day, and for many sunny Sundays thereafter, we gathered by the lake to be entertained by a mixture of David's own compositions and songs by his favourite musicians, Cat Stevens, The Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, and his beloved James Taylor. Sweet Baby James was always the first song of the day. It's a cliché to say that parks in any city are a haven, and New Yorkers often refer to the park as a lung, the green space that made life in the surrounding concrete cavern bearable, that enabled you to breathe, particularly in the scorching heat of a New York summer. But our musical experience in the park was more than that. It was a coming together of people, older and younger, some from the wealthy Upper East or West sides of Manhattan, others from the poorest districts of the Bronx and Queens, others again just visiting the city, united in a love of gentle music and a momentary escape from the madness of New York life. I won't pretend we made lifelong friends there, but there were faces we came to recognise as you do on your daily commute. We would nod and smile and shout out requests for our favourite songs. David's own compositions were sometimes satirical, one, recalling the days when mobile phones were still used for conversation rather than texting, ironically asks his fellow train passengers to talk louder. That's the seventh call you're dialing or receiving. We all need to know the crap you did last evening. Please talk louder. and there were melancholy songs, my favourite being a lament for a lost love, known as Wedding in Danville. 10 years have flown so quickly, it seems like another life, since I felt my heart stop beating when she became his wife. We left New York in 2008, taking many memories and a few of David's CDs with us. 10 years flew by quickly for me too, but in 2018 I went back to New York for a work trip. I extended my stay to the weekend to see if that guitar man, as David called himself on his website, might be in the park. I entered this time from the west side, not through the Ramble, so I saw him before I heard him, with guitar and loudspeaker in the same spot as before. A bit older, a bit greyer, in a t-shirt this time rather than stripped to the waist, but the blue jeans and Sweet Baby James were still there. In his signature song, People on the Hill, David expressed his gratitude for what we, his audience, had given him, had meant to him, as he sang and plucked his guitar strings, or as he put it, "You'll find me standing by the lake, where the children feed the birds, picking till my fingers ache, singing other people's words." His words had meant a lot to me, and still do. I'd never told him that before. This time, with a bit of a catch in my throat, I did. He looked genuinely touched. I know I was. I see from his website that he's still in the park, entertaining a new generation in that community in the moment that he and we call the people on the hill.
Got some dreams I love to chase. I got my head where it belongs. I got my heart in a real good place. Singing other people's songs. You find me standing by the lake.
I'm standing in Rathanesca on the site of where my father had his forge in days gone by. Stretching out in front of me is a 700-acre site where soon ploughmen and women from all over Ireland will compete for titles in the National Ploughing Championships. The ploughing always takes place in September, when the harvest is done and farmers can take a break. Very few people had even heard of Rathanesca until the ploughing championship started here in 2013. It's spelled as if it should be pronounced Rathanesca, but for whatever reason, we locals have always called it Rathanesca. I walk on up the road alongside the site, with Jim Murphy's Hill on my right, turn left at the church and past the schoolhouse for the local national school where I spent many happy years with the master, Mr. O'Rourke. There have been many occupants of the schoolhouse since the O'Rourkes left. They moved to Galway and we were sorry to see them go, but the friendships endured and they returned for important local milestones, including the ploughing. This year there will be lots of ploughing done on Ramsbottom's land and trade stands will cover Drennan's and Carter's fields. Business deals worth millions will be transacted here over 3 days. The woman at the helm of this great endeavour since 1973 is local Laois Wonder Woman Anna May McHugh. And as I gaze over the site, my memories go back to my father, Charlie Green, in his forge, the sweat pouring down his face, covered in black streaks. I can hear the piercing sound of the anvil. I remember the smell of the charcoal, the whoosh of the big bellows, and the hissing when he dipped the red-hot iron into the half-barrel of water. As a child, I was fascinated to read the names of local farmers etched with horse nails on the blackened wall of the forge. Recently, one of the O'Rourkes, Fran, who went on to become a professor of philosophy, published a mighty tome on Aristotle. Imagine my delight to see my father mentioned early on in the book. One of our neighbours was a blacksmith, Fran writes, who mostly mended farm machinery now that there were fewer horses to be shod. A huge bellows raised a storm of sparks in the forge as iron glowed in red-hot coals. Every time I hear the story of Pythagoras, who supposedly discovered the arithmetic of music on hearing the different pitches of the hammer's clang on the anvil, I think of the forge in Rathenesca. Structured ploughing championships began back in 1931 when men from two counties, Kildare and Wexford, wanted to decide which county had the better ploughmen. Little over a decade later, in 1943, the ploughing came to Lamberton, a Queen Anne-style house and estate a mile over the road from us. My father often talked of this event when, as a young blacksmith, he shod a fair number of the 100 horses provided for the competition by the local committee. This was during the war, when diesel and petrol were scarce. Ploughing was mostly done by horses in teams. The competitors arrived by train to Portlaoise station and the ploughs were carted by road the 5 miles out to Lamberton. Spectators came mostly by bicycle. Old photos show rows upon rows of bicycles thrown along the walls of the estate. How anyone ever found their own bike again is a mystery. The ploughing was a much smaller one-day event back then. Photos show 3 tents in comparison to the 1,700 today. Catering was done in the open in a big cauldron. Tea leaves were rationed at that time, but a lady called Mrs. Hume got permission to use petrol to drive her car around, gathering tea leaves from provision stores all over County Laois. It must have been an amazing event at the time. But surely no one could have imagined how it would grow over the next 80 years. This year there'll be an entire food village, fashion shows, craft demonstrations and a national brown bread making competition. Almost 300,000 people travel to Rathenesca annually and the ploughing, as far as I know, is now the largest outdoor trade event in Europe. And I can't help but think of how proud my father would be that history has come full circle. Despite farmers these days having tractors costing hundreds of thousands of euro, there'll be horses ploughing again outside the door of where his busy forge used to be. This year, I'll be there in his memory, proud of the years he spent hammering red-hot iron on the anvil in his forge in Rathenesca.
Turn down the greens, O man who ploughs, guide them the plough with sharp and share. Turn up the brow to sapphire skies, mankind on thee.
I was introduced to Lou Reed's album Transformer in 1976. My brother showed me the back of the album cover, speaking conspiratorially. "That's him," he said. "That's Lou Reed." I couldn't believe it. Was it possible that this curvy, made-up confection of beauty was the same person as the man on the front of the album? Why would he want to transform like that? The answer must lie with Holly, Little Joe and Candy too. The more I listened to the LP, the more bemused, yet entranced I became. I imagined myself the participant in a perfect day, feeding animals in some groovy zoo, far removed from Dublin Zoo, which I had visited on a school tour, ham sandwiches and all. Meanwhile, there were song contests to be entered. I was a member of a local girls' club, a somewhat grimier version of the Girl Guides. The woman in charge, let's call her Betty, was plump, grey-haired, redoubtable. She was assisted in club organisation by some older teenagers of the livelier kind. These were the girls who were always called upon to sing in public. They were good-looking and cheerful, but extraordinarily tribal. You had to live on the same street as them to be accepted as an equal. My friends and I considered them to be Betty's pets and suspected she favoured them above us. The song contest was a case in point. Betty announced details of it in early January. We had until March to compose a song. The winner would be announced in time for St. Patrick's Day. There would be a cash prize. I would like to be able to tell you of all the days and nights I spent attempting my own composition. I would like to think that I was unsure of the rules of copyright and unfamiliar with plagiarism. But I must admit that I ignored all ethical considerations and went straight to Lou Reed's Transformer. Not just for inspiration, but for material. Surely one of these fantastic songs would do the trick. The glory, and not least the cash prize, would be mine. First, I thought a perfect day, but I had already played it to some of my friends who were in the girls' club and they might tell. I ruled out other songs after examining the lyrics. Too risque. After much re-listening and deliberation, I decided on Wagon Wheel. Won't you be my wagon wheel? Won't you tell me, baby, how do you feel? I sang while shimmying round the sitting room, working on my accompanying moves. I spent hours perfecting my routine, flinging myself round the room and whooping. I even managed a Lou-type growl in the line, yeah, you gotta live, yeah, your life, and make a point of having some fun. Then I realised that there was a problem with the phrase, just kick her in the head and rearrange her. Somehow I had missed this clear exhortation to violence. I had to rethink the whole thing. Satellite of Love was my next choice. It was catchy and the lyrics seemed harmless enough. Satellites gone up to the skies. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Fine. On the night of the song contest, dressed in purple hot pants, I was filled with a sense of destiny. I was up last, which was a good place to be, as the judges, that is, Betty, would remember my song best. I was too nervous to concentrate on the other performances, but my impression was that their work was banal. When my turn came, I moved to the top of the room like a girl transfixed. I could hear and see nothing else. It was just me and my song. The stage was a bit cramped for shimmying and full-on whooping, so I couldn't put my sitting room best into my performance. But afterwards, exhilarated, I gave myself a medium to high rating. My singing was good. Not too nasal. I had taken advice from my brother on this point. My dancing was as good as could be expected, considering the constraints. I was a bit surprised that the audience's reaction was somewhat more muted than I'd anticipated. But I took that for jealousy. I felt confident of the prize. How could anyone else at Girls Club come up with something as fabulous as Satellite of Love? Turned out that one of the townies with a good voice did, in Betty's judicious view. Teresa, with the ready smile and the good singing voice, won the prize. Her song was about our town when the daffodils were out. It couldn't have been more anodyne. I almost forgot that I had cheated. Such were the depths of my outrage over the injustice of it all. My anger turned to disbelief. But then came the comforting feeling of superiority. The sad reality was that I was surrounded by lesser beings who were simply incapable of appreciating Lou Reed. It was a case of pearls before swine. After that, I kept his music to myself.
Satellites gone up to the skies. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Satellite.
The documentary archives of my daughter's Dublin school go back 150 years. I can never resist a deep dive into the history of girls' education or sport or women's working lives or Dublin itself. So an afternoon picking through papers in these archive boxes tickles my nerdish fancy. There's treasure here, if you count a sock last washed in the 50s or a photograph of a school goat as treasure, which I do. Today, two notebooks nestle in a cardboard corner. The smaller one is inscribed L. Vaughan Cookery Notes, 28 Crosthwaite Park East, Kingstown, October 1918. The second reveals more, Lily C. Vaughan. Lily Coletta Vaughan was for nearly 50 years the principal of the Hall School in Monkstown. She grew up in what is now Dunleary and attended the Hall, a private Church of Ireland boarding school. It was close to home and it was also more or less the Vaughan family business. Founded in 1872, it had been bought by Lily Coletta's grandfather and run by her two aunts until one of them died and the other lost interest. In 1929, aged 28, Lily Coletta, now Miss Vaughan, took up the reins and did not lay them down again until the school centenary year in 1972. The Hall was a progressive educational space, carved out by women for women. Early on, it included a kindergarten revolving around singing, dancing, nature and creative play. Even in the 1870s, it offered girls experimental science, later emphasising maths and offering Latin. Miss Vaughan moved into the school, and from then on, her life centred on it, on the buildings and facilities, her staff, her pupils and their parents. She did have other interests. She loved her slide camera and used it to document the school year, from the boarders' return in September, through plays and prize days, lacrosse and hockey matches, to the summer terms tennis, sea swims and sports days. She adored dogs, and every August the school opened its grounds to a dog show. Her spaniel, Samson, was her constant companion and a regular attendee at events, not only those at the school. The Irish Times photographed Samson and Miss Vaughan together at an exhibition opening at the Victor Waddington Galleries in Ann Street. She once spent a term's fees at Waddington's, 57 guineas, buying Fergus O'Ryan's painting Skipper Alley to hang over a mantelpiece at the Hall. Photography, sport, dogs, art. All compatible with school life, these were Lily Coletta Vaughan's preoccupations. In photographs, she is tall and beautifully dressed, draped in bracelets, earrings and ropes of pearls. Several photographs show her in the school dining room and often the kitchen staff pose too, with a Christmas pudding or birthday cake. There were four meals a day during term time, so Miss Vaughan need never have cooked at all. But she kept all her life these two notebooks stuffed with recipes, all pointing to food as another preoccupation. Lily Coletta was 17 when, in careful fountain pen, she first defined cooking methods, then wrote out 50 individual recipes, starting with Egyptian soup, mainly lentils, and ending with chocolate pudding, mainly breadcrumbs. This is the most spattered and stained page, quite filthy with use. In the later notebook, Christmas cake and mince pies have absorbed the most spots and splashes. Brown with age, the page is translucent with smears of fat. Here, the more rapid handwriting and the newspaper clippings slipped inside suggest that Miss Vaughan kept this notebook as a grown-up. Some recipes were for the girls, like boned fowl for fourth years. Poor them. Told to have fowl plucked and singed, cut skin with skewer, take out sinews, cut off leg below joint. They also learned to cook the unappetizingly titled stewed mutton à l'anglais, served with pastry rings filled with diced carrots and peas. Third-year pupils mastered green pea soup, thickened with flour and flavoured with mint, and celery soup, unexpectedly meaty with its base of brown stock and dripping. Some of the recipes, like warm, yeasty coffee rolls, definitely deserve a comeback. Others, like baked stuffed tripe, might not be widely tempting. All comers could conjure Eiffel Towers, constructed of shapes cut from a shilling Madeira, as she puts it, or recall or imagine the flavours of travel abroad with German cream, French shortbread, Syracuse pudding, Russian sandwich, or a buttered Jenny Lind cake named for the Swedish nightingale. Anything could be pickled, from mushrooms to nasturtiums, and anything could be boiled, from rabbit to the fruitcake boiled and typed up in 1956. We're used to reading cookbooks spilling over with lush narrative and mini-memoir. Miss Vaughan's recipes barely even mention taste beyond the brisk instruction, season. When a simple apple snow warrants a rare, pretty touch, decorate with a few cherries. It feels almost frivolous. The life of a person from the past is remote, but understanding the food they prepared and enjoyed feels intimate. An oatmeal biscuit, a spoonful of blackberry jam, a pickled onion are familiar, ordinary foods. Against the background of an influenza pandemic, a four-year war winding down, a general election, a proscribed Doyle, and a brewing war of independence, a 17-year-old Dubliner filled a pen and wrote out recipes. Why, when her job later rendered cooking entirely unnecessary, did she keep these notebooks all her life? Perhaps a keen interest in the domestic science syllabus, or the creativity of cooking. Perhaps this smartly dressed powerhouse longed for the carby comfort of a toothachingly sweet homemade syrup sponge when she eased off her mid-heeled shoes and curled up on her chaise longue with Samson on her lap, exhausted after another day educating the daughters of privilege.
On this morning's programme we heard The Butcherer by Carol Taff, Boys Do Cry by Colin Regan, Sundays in the Park with David was by Paul Johnston, I'll See You at the Ploughing by Margaret Dunn, Satellite of Love was by Fiona Smith, and Miss Vaughan's Cookery Notes by Antonia Hart. The music was Ticket to Ride by The Beatles, performed by the Ennis Brass Band and conducted by Mark Nutley, recorded at a live miscellany event in Glower, Ennis, a few years ago. He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, by Bobby Scott and Bob Russell, sung by the House Martins. People on the Hill, by David Ippolito. The Plough, written by J.J. Bergen and sung by Aileen Lambert and Kathleen Byrne. And Satellite of Love by Lou Reed. If you'd like to catch the next performance of the Butter Exchange Band, as mentioned in Carl Taff's script, they'll be playing in their band room in Cork City at 7 p.m. on Culture Night. That's Friday the 20th of September on Dominic Street, Shandon, just by the Butter Museum and the Firkin Crane. And the song The Plough was recorded as part of the Blackwater Song Project in County Wexford some years ago. To find out more, see aileenlambert.com. Sunday Miscellany's own Advance Culture Night celebration takes place next Friday, the 13th of September, in the form of a special recording hosted by the President and Sabina Higgins at Áras an Uachtaráin. All audience tickets for this event have now been allocated, but we'll be announcing details of our next live event soon. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio app and at the programme website.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.